Welcome to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable, where real people share real stories. We're coming to you from Town Place Suites by Marriott Studio, located right here in the Rio Grande Valley, the front line of the USA. I'm Rico, ATP, and riding shotgun is, hey bro, did he just say that?
I did.
Roland Reyes, and rounding out the crew is the Quad Father. We're just two ATPs in a quad with a microphone and a mission and a whole lot of passion. This podcast is about real people, real stories, and real power. Spotlighting life after injury, adaptive technology, and the voices reshaping what it means to roll forward. So buckle up, because at this roundtable, we're not just talking, we're building a movement. Gentlemen, how was your Halloween?
It was good.
It was high in glucose.
I got a single candy.
No?
No.
How was it with your grandkids, man?
Oh, it was wonderful, dude.
What were they dressed up as?
Oh, God, I don't know what that is. I really didn't recognize Toy Story stuff.
Toy Story stuff? Yeah. That's like, what, 20
they're
years
babies,
old?
They're babies.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, they're babies. Enjoy it, man.
Yeah.
There's a lot of kids that dressed up at school.
Yeah, my son.
I dressed up.
My son lives in a really cool neighborhood that they go out of their way, dude. Like, it was a party down the block. It looked like Mardi Gras, 6th Street on a Saturday.
Why didn't you call me, man? I've got nothing to do.
I know, it was great. Yeah, we walked around for a little bit. Got a little winded, but, you know, good to go. Yep. Then had some refreshments afterwards.
Yes, you did.
Some refreshments. Yeah. Is that what we're calling them?
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, I didn't do anything.
I was held hostage.
You just chilled? I just went to Olive Garden, got something to eat, and had a 5K this morning.
Oh, okay. Nice.
Yeah, so I was at over in Mission. I was at the trail and bike. So
what was the
5K? Was Dia de los Muertos.
Oh, okay.
Stretched, did my thing, and 2 miles in, I decided to kick it up to another gear to show them what I got and pulled my right calf. So I came in fifth. I had 38 minute. Out of 19, I came in fifth. My time was 38 minutes.
Congratulations.
That's not bad. Good job.
Yeah, dude. I was going to try to shoot for 32. I had that guy in my sight. Because, I'm in the 50 to 60 category.
Yeah,
the young guy, so I might as well enjoy it while I can. Something else that I saw, dude, there's another mother trucker parked in your handicap sticker downstairs.
You still snitching, dude?
I haven't snitched on this one because I think it's the owner because they were driving a G-Wagon.
You don't want to do that. No, that's not what it... I don't think that's what they drive.
Really?
I don't think that's them.
What is it, man?
I don't know. You got to remember, there's a lot of people that stay here that have been here for a couple weeks already.
And?
Well, I'm just saying that's why you'll see the same vehicle after a while.
Man, I mean, it has a big-ass handicap sticker on there.
Yeah, I know.
It's one of my pet peeves, dude.
Rico's driving over here even on days we're not podcasting.
I should, right?
Just check it out.
I'm going to make those Mickey Mouse flyers that I told you all about.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to put them on there. And yesterday, I'm getting tattoos removed. Have you heard about how tattoo removal shit?
I heard it's painful.
Oh, yeah, brother. Oh, boy, is it painful. I had one on my leg. I was like, 19, got fairly intoxicated, and I woke up with an ugly-ass tattoo on my leg. So I'm getting that blasted off. It does freaking hurt. But I just want to shout out to the Rejuvenate Med Spa, locally located 105 East Nolana Avenue, McAllen, Texas. Ask for Megan when you get out there. They do a fantastic job, and they will take care of you.
Well, I can see why you're shouting them out.
Oh, yeah, buddy.
Doing a good job.
Roland, who do we got on the show today?
We got a great guest. Today's guest is Mario Bonponte, a man whose story redefines determination from tearing up BMX tracks as a kid, turning his pro card in road racing at just 16. Mario's always lived life at full throttle, but in 2006, everything changed in an instant after a BMX accident left him facing a new kind of challenge, one that tested not just his body, but his mind and spirit. Refusing to let his injury define him, Mario dedicated years to intense rehab, rebuilding his life through relentless effort and an unbreakable mindset. His story is about grit, growth, and never backing down, even when the odds say you should. In this episode, we dive into Mario's journey from the track to recovery, how he keeps pushing limits, and what it really means to turn tragedy into triumph.
Nice. I like that. Mario, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mario.
How you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
We're doing pretty good, man.
You're welcome.
It's a Saturday, so we're doing all right, man. We're super excited to have you on the show. And
for sure.
On the pre-call yesterday, Roland and I got on and Danny got on and quickly realized that this guy's a real badass and we weren't prepared. So we did our homework last night and got caught up with you. So now we're going to do justice. We're going to do right by you, my friend. So tell us a little bit about yourself, man. Tell us your story.
Like your first bikes and your first show of interest in that, you know, it's a great place to start.
I mean, my first show of interest, I don't know if everyone feels this way, but I kind of always felt like I was supposed to ride a motorcycle. That was just my destiny when I was a baby, a kid. I saw my dad's first picture and he's jumping his dirt bike. And I was just kind of like what I always wanted to do. And my parents couldn't afford it when I was younger. So I wanted to ride motorcycles. I never really cared about, I mean, bicycles was one thing, but as a kid, you want to do what's you think is the coolest, right? So I saw them riding motorcycles. I thought that was great and whatever. My parents couldn't afford it, so they could do what they could for me when they could. And they ended up getting me a BMX bike and started doing that, which was a great area to start for figuring out body awareness and transitioning from there to taking it into what I'm going to be in next. Never really knew where it was all going, but I always wanted to be on something with a motor. So kind of catching up. I did pretty well on my BMX bike the years I was doing it, but my bike ended up getting stolen and I thought my dad was playing a joke on me, and I thought he, because I'd been begging for a motorcycle, and I thought he ended up taking it to work with him that day and was going to sell it and trade it in and bring back a bike, and I ended up calling him. And this is when I was real young. This was in like 1997. I was like 7 or 8, and my dad, he tells me, a bike better be in the garage when I get home or you're going to be in trouble, you know? And he never didn't bring a dirt bike home. And the bike got stolen right out of my garage. So I was done racing BMX from that point forward. Took a couple years to get my motocross bike. So my parents couldn't afford it. So I started playing football and hockey and other sports and whatnot. Then just kind of when my parents finally could afford it back, like around junior high time, they gave me an option whether I was going to play football or hockey or whatever. Or I was going to start racing motocross. To me, it was no option. I just decided that was what I was going to do. I was going to race motocross, and that was my new hobby, life, everything. I was gonna, because it's so expensive. My parents were like, you can't, we kind of sat me down and had a serious talk with me, and they couldn't really afford it. So it was just a huge blessing that they allowed me to do that. So I couldn't just be wasting time and effort and everything else along the way. So I had a friend of the family, they offered some land at the time, and we ended up building a track. And 7th and 8th grade, I would go there after school. My dad would take me, and I'd burn 5 gallons of gas every day on the track. And I couldn't go play or do anything before that. I couldn't go do my homework. I had to go burn 5 gallons of gas before I did anything. And that was like the most beneficial thing that I saw moving forward. Like every time I go to the races every week, that was like the first thing I saw, like training and the consistency in my training and actually watching it pay off, and how like the addictive reward that you get from the training factor and everything else, all the effort you're putting in, the blood, sweat, and tears, essentially, seeing how much better I was getting than the kids behind me and how much time I was able to put on the bike and how much easier it was to get to learn how to ride and how to transition skills and how to build upon what I was learning. And it was a very rewarding, but at the same time, it was hard. Cause like at the same time, I wanted to go hang out with girls and my buddies are going to hang out with the girl that I was hanging out with and wanted to talk to. It's like, at certain times I was like, dude, I'm fast enough, bro. Like I'm doing well. I don't need to go practice today. And my dad's like, nope, that's the wrong mindset. You got to put in 2 double time laps a day, like kind of thing where it's think different, but it's a, you sacrifice to succeed. So at that point I knew what I had to sacrifice, and I wanted to succeed in that other area. And so I was sacrificing things that I justifiably thought was a reasonable exchange in my mind, and it all paid off. So I was very grateful for that and grateful for the opportunity. And that kind of speed up forward, I was working for my dad. I ended up doing independent studies because I was racing so much that they kicked me out of school until they recommended I do independent studies because I was missing so much school. So I started doing that. And they ended up kicking me out because I was supposed to check in once a week. But when road racing, let me back up real quick. But so I was doing that during motocross and stuff.
Amar, I got a question for you. So you started off in BMX at what age?
Trying to recall the exact age, but it was about 6 or 7, something like that.
Nice.
Wow.
So as soon as I was able to get on the bike, but you know, just, yeah.
From the time from BMX you shot over to motocross, how long were you on BMX?
Not long. Maybe 2 years, maybe running out of, we did like the nationals and stuff for a good amount of time. And I got up to intermediate, but I got stripped. My bike was taken away, and it wasn't a cheap bike, so I couldn't get another one.
Gotcha. So I know with BMX racing, what I've heard, it's, you know, the emphasis is on fast starts, bike handling, and also aerial control. But the races are short compared to where you're going to motocross. So how much did, you starting out with BMX, I would think you have more freedom of your upper body to move around. You're trying to get that corner, you're doing jumps, you're doing your stuff. So when you transition to motocross, how much of a change was it knowing that, okay, well, I can't lean to one side. I really can't pull the bike back as easy as I could. What was a big challenge for you transitioning from BMX to motocross?
The biggest challenge, I guess, the weight of the bike, I guess, would be a challenge, adjusting and understanding how to manipulate the weight of the bike.
It's like, 200 pounds maybe?
Something like that. Maybe for like a smaller bike, 80 or something. But that was probably the hardest thing. But just once you understand that, you have the throttle to compensate. Once you figure out how maneuver and manipulate the controls, you're able to kind of do what you want with this. And then you have the suspension. So it's a very easy transition. So jumping is very easy. Learning awareness, body awareness in the air is what BMX taught me the most. You have to be so specific and so precise because you don't have control over like the suspension. So if you case it, you're losing tons of speed, tons of momentum, and you're not going fast that way. So you got to be smooth, and smooth is fast. So that transitions across the board in any situation you're in.
You said something that caught my attention. So a body awareness, how important is that transitioning from BMX to motocross?
Extremely important, and just in general in life and fighting. And so I got learned my body awareness. I started martial arts when I was 3 years old, and then I wanted to be a ninja. So I told my mom I wanted to be in gymnastics. So I started doing gymnastics and martial arts since I was really little. And that helped me learn body awareness just in the air and understanding where I'm at and kind of orientation and such. And that transitioned over very well to just being able to just being comfortable in the air and not freaking out, being smooth and just learning how to use momentum and going with inertia, essentially, instead of fighting gravity.
Did the mental focus and confidence come to you pretty easily when you made that transition?
Yeah, I never really knew a difference. I guess I've kind of been screwed up since I was a kid. So like I was just always climbing on the highest thing I could find, jumping off of it, trying to fly, like tying blankets around my neck, thinking I'm Superman. Like I was never afraid of anything, which is the problem, my biggest issue, where I wasn't afraid of getting hurt. I've never feared pain. It's just part of life. And I don't know. It's never really been an issue for me to have any type of confidence in a scary situation. I think they did a brain scan and my amygdala is somewhat turned off, my flight or fight part of my head. And I don't know if that's because I've had so many concussions or if I was born like that, but it's definitely affected. So yeah, they say if you have a certain amount of concussions before you're 15 years old, that you have your pain tolerance is a certain level and certain things are screwed up in your brain. So I've had way too many concussions for the average human being. I can say that.
Very well said, buddy. So when you went from, is it the motocross, you went into, how long were you there? I think you said you were only able to do it till you were, 17 or you aged out or something with a Moto X?
No, I was doing it until I was 15.
And that when you got your pro card?
That was when I transitioned into road racing because...
I got you.
I don't know a limit in anything I ever do. So my dad took all my things with wheels away from me, like my bicycles, dirt bikes and scooters and skateboards and everything essentially. And that was like my new career. I was had people paying for me to go racing once I, so I'll back up a little bit so I can tell you I got road racing, I guess. So when I was doing the motocross stuff till I was 15 years old, I literally just got home from a national. I went to Mammoth National and did really well at that and came back and stoked on my victories or whatever from that event. Like I was telling you guys yesterday, I was working for my dad at the time and I was working in San Jose and I was commuting with him and I was about to get my license when I turned 16 and I was 15 at the time so I can get a motorcycle. So I was talking to them about, that's how I got into road racing stuff and the whole road race topic came up. I never wanted to road race my entire life, never even watched one, never saw one ever. So brought it up to them and that's kind of how I transitioned into the whole that whole area of racing is just needing a bike for commuting and then needing to know how to ride it better than I actually should have. So. I don't know if you guys want me to get all into that again, but I can, it's up to you. However, how much detail you want me to fill in on that?
Yeah, for sure.
So just kind of how I explained it yesterday, essentially.
Yeah, go for it, man.
So that was, it was a really trippy time and experience just cause I love motocross. It's a passion. It's a very passion driven sport to ride motorcycles in general, but I think motocross, you gotta be a little crazier than some people cause it's, you're expecting to fall every time you go out. Like it's a regular thing and that's not a normal mindset, I don't think. But transitioning into road racing, I'm trying to think how to explain this. I got my bike, so I talked to my parents about it and talked them into it basically after a 2-hour argument, conversation type thing, and convincing them that I can be responsible and blah, 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 and all the other nonsense that goes along with owning a motorcycle. And so my dad's rule was that I was going to have to learn how to ride the bike, and that was cool with me. So he was going to call one of the local track promoters to see if he can get some track time or whatever with the whole find a track day that I can go race or go practice and learn how to ride the bike on a closed course racetrack kind of thing and don't have to worry about the traffic and public and all the other nonsense that along with. So he gave me my background. I was 15 years old. I didn't have my license yet, so I was still not really allowed to ride on the street. So I hadn't ridden the bike at all. Gave my buddy a call. Let me borrow some leathers. I went up there, bought some actual race tires so I can ride it properly. Showed up and he set me up with one of the pros on staff or whatever for the day. I'll have to circle back about this. I didn't tell you guys this yesterday. And it's kind of sad. He takes me out and he says, okay, I'm going to follow you out there. Kind of see what you gauge your abilities. Kind of, I know you've raced motocross or whatever and heard you been around the block once or twice, but I'm going to see what you've got today. And if I pull in front of you and tap my tail, just that means I want to talk to you. And we have some stuff to figure out kind of thing. And follow me into the paddock and we'll discuss it. I'm like, all right, cool. So head out there. And literally the first corner, I stick my leg out like I'm dirt tracking. And I just wasn't used to it. There's so much speed and just such a different situation, such a different experience. So like the third corner, the dude pulls in front of me, taps his tail, pulls me in through the infield, immediately takes me into the paddock and shuts my bike off right when we get past the pit wall. And he's like, dude, what are you doing, bro? He's like, you're going to kill yourself or someone else out here. Like, you need to relax, man. Like you used to race motocross, didn't you? And I'm like, yeah, man, how could you tell? And he basically breaks down riding situations. Like he's like, you're completely changing your body position the wrong way. Like you're trying to hang off the bike like you would on a motocross bike, expecting there to be ruts and bumps and big old dirt clods out here when the track's not going to change every lap, dude. Perfectly smooth, and you just want to change your center of gravity, hang off as far as you can and put as much tire back down on the ground as possible so you can twist the throttle and have more rubber on the ground than the next guy and twist the throttle harder. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. And the minute he told me that, my lap time just started dropping like 10, 15 seconds at a time. And yeah, it was really cool. It all made sense at that point. Didn't feel as sketchy on the bike. Everything kind of felt comfortable and I was able to actually find my style and find my rhythm and figure out how to ride the damn thing. Cause it's a whole new adventure. It was an experience to say the least, but I did really well. And the owner of the track day actually ended up being, by the end of the weekend, ended up being my first sponsor. He pulled my parents aside and he's like, hey man, like your son seems to be doing pretty well on this thing. He's like, typically don't recommend anyone kind of go in that direction or whatever with taking their license on the first time out and blah, blah, blah. But he seems to be picking it up pretty well. And you guys are already here and spent the money on tires. And if you guys want to stay for the weekend, you're welcome to stay. And this is like, they test out twice a year for licensing. I don't even know if it's like that anymore with the industry so backwards and upside down, but that's how it used to be. You had to test out and stuff and qualify. So I did and ended up testing out. That was my new career from that day forward. We went home. My dad and I tore the bike apart. We figured out how to build a race bike and looked up the rule book online and just went to town. That day forward, I was no longer racing motocross and my bikes had to sit in the garage and I couldn't touch them and I was racing street bikes and that was my new career.
Mario, this is Roland. You mentioned your dad quite a bit and the level of support he provided for you. Talk about how important that was in your development and what it means to you.
Well, I'll even say he's my stepdad, so he's freaking amazing.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Yeah, so he was a heavy equipment mechanic. So he raced motocross as a kid. So he opened up that avenue for me to be able to have the privilege to go and do that from just early age. But it was really cool. We worked as a team really well, surprisingly, because we don't really get along. We get along great. Don't get me wrong, but like we bicker, we butt heads, and we're very alike. So we're both very stubborn and have our own ways of doing things. But when we're on the track, when we're around bikes, he had his job, I had mine, and we went out and did them very well together as a team before I had people.
Typical father son, yeah. What's your father's name?
Name is Christopher.
Shout out to Christopher.
Yeah, so it's been, and he actually took it the hardest, which sucks, but yeah. My parents, everyone kind of went south, and I didn't have time to figure all that crap out. I just kind of stopped thinking about it and just moved forward, and I knew my time was ticking as far as a racer goes, as far as being on the clock and being as old as I was and having a time to actually make it a reality to go still race as a career. I didn't have time to stop and think about all the crap that was going on. So I just tried to address the problems at hand like I would before. Like if it was like a regular broken arm or broken ankle or whatever, like waking up in the hospital like I had before every time I did, and just move on forward with rehab and just tackle every challenge I have as it presents itself.
So take us back to getting your pro card and racing, road racing. Lead us up to the day of the accident.
When I was 17, that was when I broke my neck, September 2006. Yeah, I just got off work for the day and I was basically on my normals Friday afternoon and my buddy gave me a call and he's like, we're going to go to the football game later. We're going to find some girls, blah, blah, blah. Do you want to roll with us? And I was just like, and that time I was doing independent studies. I was like on my own mission. So I wasn't really hanging out with people. I was just doing my own thing and just on a mission to get out of just make my dreams reality, basically, and was living my dream, essentially. And so I was like, yeah, give me a call. I'm going to go for my typical road bike ride, 30-mile loop or whatever, and I'll be done in about an hour, and I'll give me a call. We'll figure it out. And so I head out and take off to do my little loop or whatever, my spandex and stuff. And as I'm on my ride, my buddies hit me up, and they're like, hey, dude, my other set of friends are bicycle riders and such, and we just finished up the six-pack, dude. Come check it out, blah, blah, blah. It's like, it's on your way. And so it wasn't my normal path where I was headed. Like, yeah, dude, I'll be there in like 10 or 15 minutes. I'm on the way right now. And so I ended up pulling up on them. And there's a group of kids, I don't know, like 15 kids or whatever. And these jumps they're no joke. They're gnarly. Like kids that built them, they're all doing Rampage now, Red Bull Rampage stuff and downhill mountain bikes and just sending it. Just, I remember just pulling up and they're all trying to figure out who's going to hit them first. And I've always been a test dummy since I was a kid. So I was like, dude, you guys going to hit these things or what? You know, I got to keep my blood pressure up. I got to keep moving. I got plans this evening. Let's go. I want to see you guys hit it. And no one wanted to do it. So I'm like, dude, give me your bike. So I took my buddy's bike and rolled up to like the roll, and the roll was super sketch. Like there was a bunch of trees and it was super muddy. And 3 days before, like 3 days in a row before this, they got chased out by bees. So like we were not supposed to be there. These jumps were not supposed to be there by any means. But anyways, we were there. And there was like something chasing me that month before my injury. Like I crashed my practice bike, crashed my race bike, crashed my car, crashed my freaking bicycle before I broke my neck real hard. And then there was like a grim reaper chasing me that month. Something was trying to take me out. But I told you guys. So I go up, drop in, and it throws me so far in the trees that I'm just like, freak. I just throw the bike away, toss it away, just land on the trail, flat bottom, bruise my heels. I don't know if you guys ever land on your heels and like crack your heel or whatever. And it's brutal. So I like limp off the trail, crawl off the trail, sit in the dirt, and my two buddies go up that I mentored as a kid, taught them how to build dirt jumps, taught them how to do whatever. And they go up and they send it, case it, but they don't fall. So I'm like, all right, dude, I gotta like, that was a whole ego and pride thing kicks in. That's when I learned about ego and what it really is. And I had nothing to prove to anyone. And I just, I'm like, all right, dude, I gotta prove this to myself, like kind of thing. I'm like, let some dirt jumps, some freaking mounds of dirt defeat me. I've done way cooler stuff than this. This is whatever. So I go up again, thinking like I'm whatever, and roll in, hit it, case it. And I'm like thinking I gotta grease this thing to actually make it be qualifying in my head. I was actually doing it. So I go up again, third time, hit it, throw a little style in there, like nice little turn down, little whip, nice and buttery landing, super greasy, and just felt so good. Like as I remembered, I got the feeling it was just make a perfect landing, nice and smooth, and it's just such a good feeling. I was like, oh man, this is why I used to do this. This is cool. This feels good. So I'm just gonna, in my head, thinking this is my last run of ever. I'm gonna be on a bicycle. I'm never moving forward, moving out of this country next year or whatever, go racing. And I'm gonna mic drop this. I'm just gonna hit this whole six pack and let these guys take care of it. And I'm just gonna go to dinner and have fun with these girls tonight. Blah, blah, blah. That's what I'm thinking in my head. So I go up to back to the drop in. The jumps get progressively bigger. So I hit it with a little more speed than I had been. And, like I said, we were riding on like 2x6s because it was all muddy. So I kind of slipped off of it and missed my approach where I hit the lip by like the width of my cell phone, at least the width of my cell phone. And just from right there, it wasn't packed and the lip just gave away. And that's like the last thing I remember from like being on my bike, being in reality, rolling, walking. So lawn darted from that lip into the next lip in front of me and threw me off the bike or whatever. And just shot straight head first into the dirt and this blacked out or whatever. I didn't even realize I hit the ground. I woke up after I was on the ground and it was like a black room and just everything was black. I heard everyone talking around me and like freaking out, and I was just face down in the dirt. And I just remember hearing everyone telling them, you roll me over, you know, they're just like, we're not gonna touch you, you could really hurt, we want to mess you up. And I just remember saying like, well, screw you guys, you know, you're my friends or what, you know, roll me over, I'm face down breathing in dirt here, and like, we're not gonna touch you. And I was like, screw you guys, I'll do it myself. And the minute I said that, I tried to flip myself over. I remember like my left arm, and just at that point I snapped out of my body, had like a just full outer body experience. I was just from that point forward just floating above everything. And I watched them sniff, like pull me off the trail and strap me in the gurney, and watched the fire truck get there, and watched my parents show up, and just everything. I watched everyone kind of run around them with this real bright entity next to me, watching that all of this happen, like 30 feet above in the air. And like the most blissful thing I've ever experienced, just complete peace, complete like comfort. There's not a worry in the world, just complete bliss. I don't know any other words for it. And I remember trying to look at the bright entity next to me, and I couldn't look. I couldn't see. It was like looking at the sun, and just remember hearing, do you want to stay or do you want to go? And I said, well, what kind of question is that? Of course I want to stay. I'm not done yet. And the minute I said, I'm not done yet, I snapped back in my body, and I was laying on the gurney, and my parents were standing above me, and I just remember apologizing to them because I knew I disrespected their wishes and everyone else's wishes that were helping. They called me sponsors and such that were my dreams of reality, essentially. And I knew that from that day forward, things were going to be a lot different. And I didn't know why. I still was in no pain. It was still a complete blissful state, essentially. Sorry from not being able to move and everything else that I didn't occur to me. I'd broken my neck. I didn't really know what that meant, but I've been strapped to a gurney plenty of times when you're immobile, and that was nothing new to me. So I was just like, okay, whatever. It's just kind of part of the situation. I don't really know what it is, but let's go with it. That's kind of how it all went down. And then they life flighted to me, and I was talking crap to the pilots, saying they need to give me better.
It doesn't surprise me.
Because they were just, I was telling you guys yesterday, my grandma was the nursing supervisor, so she was friends with them. And Yeah, I guess I was telling him my pain tolerance is too high. I need to give me, I was telling him specific drugs. Like I wanted Dilaudid as opposed to certain other ones. And then just they're laughing at me apparently. But
good choice.
Yeah. So it was an experience to say the least. So
hey Mario, this is Daniel. So you get to the hospital, I'm sure after a while you kind of get told what exactly is going on. So what was the diagnosis? What was it exactly that they told you about your injury?
Well, they didn't tell me anything. I was out for the count. They didn't know if I was going to live or die at that point. But they had told my parents I had fractured C4 and C5, disintegrated C6. So they rushed me into surgery. I don't remember any of this, but I had a halo. I remember the halo. That thing sucked balls. Get the freaking bolts out of my head. Had the halo. Yeah, you probably had one too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So they strapped a pulley to the back of my bed, and they had like weights to hang off of my bed, I guess, to pull my head straight to decompress my spine. And so that was kind of, I guess, the first day or whatever. I'm not really out how long I lasted. And then I went into two different surgeries because they fused me in the front and the rear. I don't know if they fused you in both.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That day it was in the front for me. And then a couple days later it was in the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, that thing where they were kind of using the weight for you, it was just, they were just trying to decompress. For me, they didn't do the weight. Because I remember going into the emergency room, the doctor was actually pulling on my head. And I remember like the crunching sound in my neck. And they were decompressing me that way at that point. And then shortly thereafter, I think.
For all this, though.
Yeah, I was, because I wasn't out when I got hurt. I remember everything up until right before I went under for surgery. So going in there and then putting the halo on, which, like you said, it sucked. Like I remember them pushing those damn screws into your skull, trying That's to rough. Shove that thing in my nose so I can breathe. So yeah, but at one point they were pulling on that halo once it was on my head. They were pulling it on it to decompress, and I could hear that little crunching. And then at some point I must have gone under, because that's when they gave me the injection, and then I was out. Yeah. So yeah.
I'm glad I can remember all that. That sounds rough. I woke up and I was intubated and I started freaking out. I was like, I remember trying to push it out of my tongue and I started tripping. I was like midnight. We had to get the doctor to come.
How many days went by until you kind of got your bearings about you, about what had actually happened, and kind of absorb it?
I was in an induced coma for a while, for like a week or so. I gotta check with my mom how long I was actually in an induced coma, but I was out for a minute and I don't have any real recollection of like the first two or three weeks. That was like, I was in the ICU for that point in time. And then once I left the ICU, that was when I actually remember what was going on. I was coherent. In the ICU, I was just out. They kept me sedated.
Yeah.
And I didn't really have much choice. It was just kind of, I couldn't move at that point. Everyone else was just doing everything for me. And I literally couldn't move anything. My body didn't work. It was broken. So.
Do they keep you sedated just for the swelling and for the movement?
I think it depends on the injury itself, because in some cases they might sedate you just to keep you from moving, to kind of injuring yourself some more.
No, I get it.
And then, it depends on what else you hurt. I know Mario said he hit his head pretty good. I don't know. There could be a bunch of different reasons. In his case, swelling, how much swelling there was. Was there anything else that you got hurt that may have happened, or it was just the neck area? You didn't harm anything else, like arms, shoulders, anything like that you know of?
No, I mean, I was lucky that I didn't really have a traumatic injury, brain injury for according to them. Like I told you guys yesterday, I was awake during all their questioning. I had this water body experience. I was coherent according to all them. I don't remember any of it. They're picking out dirt out of my teeth for like a week. And I was spitting dirt out because I had no helmet on. And according to the doctor, if I had a helmet on, I probably would have made it worse, because it would make the articulation further.
After that week, then after those 3 weeks, two, 3 weeks, who was the one that gave you the news then? Like, who was it? Your parents, the doctor? Who was it that told you?
I think it was the doctor. Like, because I already knew, but like, I didn't really know, until someone's like, you're not going to walk ever again, kind of thing. Until he actually says those words, it's not real. So yeah, it was like 3 weeks, I think, the doctor came and told me that. The first two questions I had was, okay, can I still have babies? And I still, because I mean, like, I surprisingly accepted it really well. I even surprised myself not thinking about it. It's part of the game. Like, I always accepted there's either you're going to die or you can get really hurt, or this is just kind of, you got to accept that part of it. And if you don't accept that, you can't really send it. Like, you're not going to ever push it as far as you really want to. And that's the reality that we deal with that. That's just how psycho you have to be, I guess, to be able to want it that bad and to be able to beat the next guy that bad. So I was pretty cool with it as far as that. And I was just like, all right, man, can I still have babies and can I still race? And he's just like, well, you have to figure it out. You still have kids with your girlfriend or whoever, and I don't know about that one. And racing is probably pretty out the window for you, man. Doesn't sound like it could, yeah. Anyways,
he was wrong.
Yeah, big time. So since you kind of already had that mindset of, you know, this could happen, did that help with the next process of getting ready to, you know, because I'm pretty much there afterwards. It's pretty much, let's see what we can do and help you get stronger with, right? So going into rehab, how was your mindset for that? Like, I guess you had accepted it and you were just kind of ready to do the work too, because like you said, you wanted to race again, right? And have babies. So I'd imagine that at that point, it's anything to just be able to do those things.
Yeah, no, like the hardest thing for me to accept really was giving up my independence. I was independent my entire life. I've been working since I was 11 years old for my own money. So I was traveling at 15 to the US by myself, just racing and doing my own thing. And so not being able to take care of myself and be able to get dressed or anything, that was a hard thing to accept. I was ready to do the work, but the work, I'm the hardest worker you'll ever find, but it's hard to do the work like anywhere. I love using a shovel. I love using a pick. I love manual labor prior to my injury, just because I know the benefit, the risk, and the reward that you get from the work you're putting in. And so like now, I mean, I'm sure you can relate. You can't just go sweeping. You can't go pick up a broom. You can't go back and you can't go put in some work. Like you want to just some real work like someone can. And so putting work in the gym is not the same. Your arms aren't going to work. They don't move. The muscles aren't turned on. They don't respond. It's like trying to make a cup float on the table with your brain.
Exactly.
It doesn't work. Trying to send signals just doesn't send. So it's putting in work is a hard thing to do, to be honest.
What could you do at that point, like physically, as far as your arms would go?
I couldn't do anything. Literally, my arms were next to me and I could move my wrist like a fraction of an inch upward, my right wrist, and they were stoked that I could move a power chair. And I thought, oh, I can still twist the throttle if that's the case.
Same thing, basically.
The hardest thing, man, was trying to get my mom to pick my nose right and freaking tell where the booger was, like to the left, to the right, and I have her scratch my face. Yeah. And then having her text girls, it was brutal. It sucked.
Yeah, or just getting, you have that itch in your hair and you just want to scratch it right and it's just never right.
Yeah, and it's like just
the worst.
It was over, but she's just missing it. Yeah, I couldn't move anything. And the first thing they had me do, like my first literal workout in ICU, or not ICU, but in rehab, is they put my arm in these slings that are just hanging from the roof. And my arms were like level in front of me. And they just told me to move my arms, just any direction, just move them. And they didn't move at all. And like I was 137 pounds, like 7% body fat. I was super lean, just on a mission, freaking training. So when I broke my neck, they say your body knows what it needs and what it doesn't need. So I lost like 35 pounds in a week because my body didn't need that. I didn't have fat reserved. I had muscle reserved. So I ate all my muscle. It was wild to not be able to move anything, to being as agile as I was. And I did a backflip off the In-N-Out sign for $5 the day before I broke my neck, like just because it's for fun. That's what I did. It was just an interesting reality to be put into and to adjust to. Like it's hard to want to work, but not be able to. It's hard to like put that into like understanding for people, I think. For one, to not be able to use your hands is so difficult. That was the hardest thing to actually figure out, was not having to use my hands and fingers and such. But I don't know how to explain it, man.
It's just the little things, right?
Your
mind is telling you, you've done this thing a million times, but you just can't do the simplest thing now. And it just sucks.
No, you can't even sit on the edge of a bed. You're like a wobbly noodle.
Yeah, you're wobbling all over the place.
Like you're sitting on a hammock.
Yeah, it's just because during therapy, I'm sure you got sit in the edge of the therapy tables, and you know it's just trying to balance, and you're like, dude, I'm gonna fall.
No, and there's a lot of falling, and that's the thing you got to accept is that progress as much as I can. And I'm okay with falling. I'm comfortable with it. I'm good with hurting myself.
You just learn how to fall.
Mario, on yesterday's pre-call, when it came to your therapy, you were labeled as unapproachable.
Yeah.
Talk about that, brother.
I mean, I've always had my own way of doing things, and they have a problem with that when they have their own way of doing things and they think that this is the way it makes it works and blah, blah, blah. I understand my body better than anybody else, and that was my understanding through the situation. So, I mean, I wasn't going to push it any way that they thought was better for me and whatnot. There was just a lot of situations where I put my foot down. I guess the people don't, and people are just, they go along with it. I'm not that person. So, the nurses that didn't speak English, they dropped me the first day in rehab, like out of getting out of my bed and out of my chair. Yeah, the nurses dropped me because they didn't know what, like they didn't speak English. So that made it even worse. So it's just like, like freaking out in a different language. Yeah. So, and then I lost it at that point. I'm like, dude, just leave me alone. My dad will pick me up. Just don't touch me anymore. You get out of my room. Like, and so stuff like that, where it was just, It was, I didn't mean to be inapproachable. I broke my neck. I was not in a comfortable situation. I didn't want to be messed around with people that didn't know what they were doing. And
Right. It
was such stupid stuff where it was like, take your medicine this right now. I need to watch you take it. I'm just, I'll take it in 30 minutes when I'm ready. Like, I don't.
God, that sounds so much like me, dude.
Yeah, it's just, and at that point, I would just put my foot down on purpose. Like, dude, you're going to make me do something? No, I'm not going to do that just because you're telling me to do that. Just, and I was just being a little jerk like that because at that point, I was being a jerk. It was whatever.
Yeah, you got to find that balance. It's sometimes it's hard to find that balance of, okay, I know what you want me to do and I know what I want to do. Let's kind of meet in the middle a little bit. But at first, it's just, yeah, you're right. Like, you just want to, you're fighting it.
But when it's unnecessary, it's like when they make things super, like there's this needs to be done right now this way, or it's not going to be wrong. It's like, no, it doesn't. Like, that's not the case. If I eat in 5 minutes, I'll be just as full. Like, it's not going to change anything. There's stuff like that where it's just, it's petty and it's stupid. And it's like, no, dude, that's not how it works.
What was the most, I guess, aside from the little things, right? What was the big thing that you kind of noticed the jump? Like, what was your first little kind of like, wow, I did this thing. What was that one goal that you kind of like, you know, after therapy, because therapy is tough. Like, you can go to therapy forever and nothing happens. And all of a sudden, it's like, there's this big thing that happens. What was that, like, thing for you that happened?
Like a tease in the hospital. And, like, one night, we were watching a movie, my friend and I, and my pinky just, like, stuck out, my left pinky. And I was like, oh, dude, right on. I'm getting my fingers back. And nope, it was just my pinky. Like, my pinky just stuck out. I moved my pinky a little bit, like, wiggle it. And that's all I got. But, like, it was, like, a false hope. But other than that, but it was... Man, I remember people coming into therapy to do demonstrations and they like get in bed and they show me how to get dressed, show us how to get dressed, and they do all this other nonsense and move around. Like thinking in my head, like, I'll never be able to do that. Like, that's not happening. Like, that's crazy. Like, and I'm still thinking in my head, I'm still going to race a car, but I don't know how it's going to happen. But this guy's putting clothes on. That's not going to happen for me. Like, I can't even transfer. That's not never going to be reality. But no, man, there's a lot of stuff like that where it was just, cause I moved to SoCal by myself with some friends. So like, I put myself in a situation where I was kind of screwed because we were all young kids, and I actually have it on my side tattooed. The first day I got dressed by myself because I had a tattoo appointment, and my buddy that was my caretaker at the time as well, we partied a little too hard. He partied a little too hard cause I wasn't really partying. I was just along for the ride. And so he was in his room still, and we had like a living room in between our apartment, and there was like a master and a master on either side of the living room, right in the middle of each. So that was like the first day I had to get myself dressed. I don't know, like, if I'm going to walk you all through it, but I just threw all my covers on the ground, because I didn't know how to get in my chair still. I still didn't know how to transfer. I threw all my covers on the ground, pillows on the ground, rolled out of bed, crawled over to the dresser, put some clothes on, like, struggled to do that, and then freaking slid my butt all the way out of my room, all the way freaking to my buddy's room. Ended up being naked again because I pants slid off of me. That was the pointless part of getting dressed. I'm banging on his door. So that was like one of the first times that I just like was done for people doing crap for me. Cause I was just like, everyone at that point started doing their own thing and just going different directions with being close to San Diego and being close to Mexico and all the things that come along with being a kid, I guess, and having too much fun. Yeah, at that point, I thought that was one of the times I literally have a tattooed on my side. I can't see the date, to be honest, but it's...
Yeah. Mario, you've been quoted as saying, I know how to go fast. I just need to know how to move my body. That was your mindset after your injury, correct? And you want to touch on that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, that's just the approach I took with designing the controls. I had to figure out what my body is able to do now and how I'm able to utilize it to the most efficient way possible to drive or to do what I want to do with it. And now it's to drive a vehicle. Just
and
essentially.
This was while you were in the hospital, correct?
No, this was because in the hospital, I couldn't do anything still. I could barely even push a chair. I could barely even sit up by myself. I couldn't feed myself. Like I couldn't do anything. If eating a burrito was out of the question, not happening.
Speaking of hospital, did you have a wheelchair that you were borrowing there, a loaner, or did you acquire a chair? Were you in a manual or power?
Yeah, so they originally wanted to put me in a power chair, and I fought them on that because I couldn't move. And they're like, you're not going to be able to push it, dude. So like, they kept trying to discourage me and put me in situations that I would fail at in a power chair or in a manual chair. And so they gave me a manual chair that was like too big and was whatever. It's kind of your situation when you go to the hospital, you got to use a chair that they have, whatever works. And so it was what it was. And that was like, but I got to test out other chairs, and I saw like my doctor was actually in a wheelchair, which was pretty cool. And she, like, I saw her chair moved with her. Like she was able to move her body, and it kind of responded to exactly whatever she was, her movements were. So I knew that my chair was whatever. Like, once I got a proper chair, I'd be in a different situation. But I still, and they called it a parkour in rehab. And they had, like, take us on these different laps around the hospital, like you go outside and go up these hills. And man, they're tiny hills looking back, like, because they're trying to get you ready for being able to push your chair in reality and like around different situations. Man, there's some stupid parts where I'm back in the hospital for doctor's appointments and thinking, man, this is a struggle back in the day, but now I push 10 miles a day and it is what it is. Not even a big deal. But yeah, it was, I couldn't move at first, man. So
what did you end up leaving the hospital with?
A manual. I never had a power chair. I've refused to ever be in one because I need the muscles. I need the workout to be able to still drive and to be able to stay in shape, to be able to do what I want to do. So I appreciate the struggle in life, and that's kind of my outlook and my take on life in general, all aspects of it. Just appreciate the struggle and find the benefit and the gain in anything you're trying to do.
So when you left rehab, you had your own wheelchair at that point, or you went?
No, they measured me for a wheelchair, but I didn't have my personal wheelchair yet. So I was still in their rental, whatever garbage. And I was waiting on my $10,000 freaking other garbage. So,
yeah. So post-hospital, take us, you and your two buddies, you moved in with two buddies, right? And started going to Project Walk?
Yeah. My buddies and I moved down to San Diego to go to Project Walk down there.
Yeah, I was stationed there for a while. I love San Diego, man.
That's the one in Englewood, the Project Walk that was in Englewood?
No, I was in Carlsbad.
I mean, Carlsbad. I don't know why I said Englewood. Carlsbad, yeah. Okay, yeah, how'd you like that? Because I was there I went there about 7 months after I got hurt. So how did that go for you?
When did you go?
That was 2008 for me. So it was before.
Oh, okay, so it was still new then.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it changed. It's changed a lot. And the owner sold it, and it's I don't know. It is what it is. But it was cool, man. It was an experience. Like, the first time someone took me out of a chair and like put me on the ground, they made me not feel like I was fragile. Like, they made me feel like I was a porcelain doll in the hospital. Like, I couldn't do anything, and they're just. A lot of crap where I'm just like, okay. And so when they put me on the ground, they're like, all right, let's roll around, maybe see what you could do with situations. I was like, oh man, I'm still like a human being. I still have a full body to use. Like, I'm not, because I told them to chop my legs off in the hospital. I'm like, dude, I don't need these things. They're just getting in the way. And then my balls were just like, they're another situation to deal with. Those things freaking, man, it's just, it is what it is. But yeah, you freaking deal with it. You figure it out. But so I think that was the coolest thing, was just kind of learning how to use my body. Because that was the biggest thing. I was trying to drag my legs. I'm trying to transfer, and I wasn't putting my legs in perfect position, the right position, and situating things that they needed to be. Because I forgot my body was mechanical and it works like a robot, essentially. It's all joints that work in certain ways. They don't bend certain ways and break things if you do. Yeah, once I learned how to use my body again, it was a lot easier to maneuver things and maneuver around, I think. And that's kind of what Project Walk helped with. But other than that, and the range of motion and the stretching and all that was good. But I didn't get much of it, much back from it, to be honest. I got more back from me being stubborn and pushing myself in other ways. But
yeah. Because they, like you said, they take you out of the chair. It's not your typical therapy. They take you out of the chair. You're crawling. You're put up against a wall. They stand you without a stander. So there's a guy and you're holding your legs, and somebody holding your hips.
Oh.
They put you in machine weights. So you sit in the machine weights, and they've got like these counterbalances sometimes to help you do certain things. Yeah, I was in all sorts of machine weights during Project Walk. Scary, because you're like, dude, what am I going to hold on to? But they've got you. A lot of times you had two or three people on you. So you felt, you know, at first you were scared, but you felt pretty secure and you got used to it pretty quickly. But it was awesome to feel, you know, the workout without being in the chair. Like a lot of times in your typical therapy, you're in a wheelchair, right?
Yeah.
And you're doing stuff out of the wheelchair here. You're not in it. The wheelchair, they just take you out. And I never saw the wheelchair until after my workout.
Really? They take it from you, literally.
Yeah, they take it and then they put it in the other room, and you were theirs for the next hour or two, whatever they had you do.
Wow.
Yeah.
So when you were done with, when you were done with Project Walk, how soon after that did you move back? I know you were in Southern California, but then I think you moved back, and that's when you started thinking about racing.
Yeah. So I was down there for about 3 years or so. I was about 20, 21, and then came back. Like I was telling you guys yesterday, I never planned to walk. Like, I went to Project Walk or whatever to kind of progress my injury as much as possible. In my head, I didn't really care to walk. I knew I was going to be jogging or running or dancing like I used to be. So it wasn't like my main priority in my head. It was something I would be great if it happened, but it was far out. So I just wanted to make myself strong enough to be able to go race a car. And that was my mindset, and be able to get in and out of the car and just personally just be able to drive as far and fast as long as possible. So once I was able to do that and able to transfer in and out of the vehicle, then I was kind of like, and Project Walk got expensive. So that was one of the main things. I couldn't afford it anymore. Places, a bank. and I lost my funding, but I stayed around there. So they're really cool. And they kept me around for like a year or so to help train the trainers, because they had open project walks around the world, and they kept bringing people in from different countries and different areas of the country and all that to train them and learn different things. And I was a pretty good trainer as far as like letting people work with me and being comfortable with them, putting my body in different positions and blah, blah, blah kind of thing. Just different races, different people that can't speak English and stuff like that. So that was a really cool experience, but at the same time, I wasn't getting great workouts because they didn't really know what they were doing. They were just kind of using me as a body, which was cool. But so anyways, I ended up leaving after that. It was all said and done, and they sold the project walk and everything transferred hands, and started researching things as I was there, trying to figure out what I could race or whatever options there are in car racing or four-wheeled industry, which it all realistically costs to do, of course, which would be the best way to be able to develop these controls in my mind that I had figured out for me to be able to design, to be able to potentially drive at the level that I wanted to, and how I can actually afford to do that without any money and any support and anyone believing that it was possible, and the easiest way of proof of concept. So I just started thinking of it like that. When I moved back to Northern California, reconnected with some people at the racetrack and on the two-wheeled industry. And at that point, it was like taboo. Like, no one wanted to talk to me. I went back to the races and no one wanted to catch it, because it's a reality that everyone knows is out there, but they don't want to see it kind of thing.
Absolutely.
And so it was really weird. Like, all my friends, my homies are just like super strange with me, but I don't know. It didn't take long. They all got comfortable again. But yeah, it was weird at first. And then I figured a go-kart was probably the best option for me. Just the most affordable option to be able to design the controls, at least to be able to prove that I can do them, and just kind of learn from there moving forward, the whole industry, what it takes to kind of put my name back together, build a brand around myself, and get some sponsors and partners to go do what I want to do and become a world champion. That has always been the goal. Yeah. So that was essentially how I started. Bought a go-kart off Craigslist. My parents didn't want to take me to pick it up, but forced them to do it. And we got that and just started taking it apart myself, like addressing what I needed to do for it, and took the measurements, made a drawing. It's on a piece of paper, just because I didn't know how to do anything at that point as far as developing a product or engineering anything. I'd never done that before, aside from fabricating as a kid with my dad and just welding things together and such. But so I drew up these general basic plans, figured out what kind of material I needed, and went to the hardware store, rolled over to the hardware store to get it, and put it all in my lap, and came back with it.
Basically designing your own hand controls, right? For self-taught engineer.
Well, that's just I'm a problem solver. I'm not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
just give me a problem and I'll figure out how to work it out. But that's kind of been my approach to life in general. Just, what do people call it? Something mindset. Freaking, my brain's drawing blanks.
What is the word for that?
Solution-oriented.
Yeah.
Termination.
All right. Once you're looking at the vehicle, you came up with generic hand controls. That's what you came up with first, which you were only able to drive with, 60% of your body? You still had to figure out how to use the 40% to get you 100%. And I think that's what led to your second generation of hand controls.
Yeah. Well, I didn't come out with the first generation. I was using just the regular Monarchs that anyone could buy. And there's just a basic hand on the throttle, hand on the brake, hand on the wheel. So
is that the generic hand controls?
Yeah. Just the push for brake, down for gas kind of thing. So very basic.
One of the things we focus on as seating wheelchair people is trunk stability and for function, you know. And if you don't mind talking a little bit about how you, I'm curious, because seating is my thing. I'm curious how you, whether you were sitting on an actual cushion or you were just sitting on a reg or whatever comes with the go-kart. And how did you support your upper trunk? And I was wondering about your seat to back angle, and whether you were tilted for a little more function. I hope you understood what I just asked. I'm sorry. It was kind of all over the place, but
no, I heard you.
You were able to be stable sitting with your trunk control.
Definitely. That's a great question.
Yeah. Thanks.
And it would have applied if I actually had gotten into the go-kart, but honestly, the go-kart seats, they hug you so well that it's like, you have a full trunk and you're in there snug, like your girlfriend's hugging you. It's super tight. So, and I have friends that race go-karts as well. They're quads and paras, and they have different seats that they use, like different carbon seats, different backs, because you break ribs in carts. They're violent. And that's one of the reasons I didn't really push this issue of getting into a cart, because I wanted to be in a car anyways. But carts are, I have friends that just break ribs all the time, because and they're paras and they got full muscular upper bodies, and like their ribs are not all bony like mine and all skinny like me. So that's one of the things.
And I think the question kind of lends itself to any vehicle you're in as far if you're racing.
Yes, like, yes, 100%.
How you deal with that.
So I actually, my first seat didn't, I guess I didn't, that's why the whole car industry is new to me. So it was new to me and I didn't know how to go about it. So I ordered a seat online to look cool. I was like, this one looks cool. This one's affordable. Let's try this one out. I didn't realize there's different size seats for reasons, and they're different manufacturers or for different people, different like body shapes. Like if you have a tall, longer core torso, there's different seats that they make for it, or like the holes come out differently for your harnesses to hit you, and they support you different areas and your back's different eight places. And there's certain things that you want and you need because it hugs you like your girlfriend. So like I got my seat and it was too big. So I ended up returning it. And then I had to like, I didn't know you can go to the shop and you literally try out seats for different body types. And it was, once I got my seat, I didn't want to get out of it, man. I was like, literally, like I said, like your girlfriend hugging you, and it's so comfortable and so cozy, and you're stuck in there and you feel like you're one with the vehicle. So you feel everything. And that's one of the easiest things. That's one of my favorite places to be, being in a chair, because it's where I feel the most supported. Cause I never feel like I'm supported being like a floppy gefilte fish in my wheelchair as it is. And I have no core stability. So like being in my car, it hugs me in so many nice places. Puts my body back together the way it needs to be aligned, because my ribs are screwed up from other injuries and stuff like that. So it feels nice and tight when I'm all strapped in my car, nice and secure, harness is all tightened down. I kept the steering as mechanical as possible, as close to the stock as possible. Like the BMW steering is very communicative, and it talks to you like a lot just through vibrations, through everything, through the road. I didn't want to numb that down in any way. And on top of that, it's more expensive to add some matte more stuff to the stuff like that and make it more technical. But that's one of the reasons I wanted to keep my strength up as high as possible, because I didn't, if and when I made the controls universally adaptable to whatever vehicle, I wanted to make it so people can put them into whatever vehicle they want and have them be minimally invasive and not to fully modify the entire interior of their car to be able to utilize them. And same respect for myself, if I had other friends, which I have, invited me to go racing in their vehicles. Now the new controls I've developed all on quick release change system. So you say like you and I, Rico, or you and I, Roland, want to go to the track together and we take the same car, we could swap out your steering wheel with my steering wheel and I don't have to fully modify the vehicle to be able to drive it. So it's stuff like that where I was taken into consideration where if it was anybody else or if it was myself, I didn't have to do a whole bunch of work to make it work.
Okay. Mario, this is Dan. I got a question about the actual driver, because you were talking about the seat. How long are you in your seat, you know, in general practice or for a race? Because I'm curious, like when you're in there for a certain amount of time, like me just driving in my truck, I got to like shift around a while. How do you do it to kind of ease the ulcers and, you know, anything like that right. could happen? Because I'd imagine that when you're driving, right, you're going to be sliding a little bit. I do, and I'm just in my truck. Like, how do you manage that kind of stuff?
Yeah, like, sure.
You just deal with it. Same thing, if you got to pee, you just pee. It is what it is, man. That's why not everyone does it. It's not a pretty thing. It's just a passion thing. Like, I'm lucky that I have really good circulation, and I don't struggle with sores very much. I will, like, for longer races, I'll add, like, a real thin cushion. It's like a, forget the name of it.
It's purple.
Sounds like a Stimulite. He's describing.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
It might be something like that. But
yeah, Stimulite. It's like a honeycomb, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like honeycomb.
Okay. Yeah,
yeah, Stimulite. Yeah, that thing is amazing, man. I love that. I use it in my chair as well. It's super consistent and it's very, it could really lighten things.
It keeps you really, really cool and lets air in there, and it's a really good cushion for that sort of
works
thing.
Works great, but I haven't had any issues as far as, and I mean, you're getting thrown around. So like if you're out there for a while and your G's are throwing you around, that's like part of it.
That's for weight shifting.
Yeah, natural weight shifting, I guess you want to call it. But it's, you're never really off of it. So like I said, luckily I have really good circulation and I haven't had to deal with too much issues with that. But yeah, I've go ahead.
Which vehicle did you put your hand controls on, the very first one?
The very first one was a BMW M3 E46. And I went with that vehicle because I was supposed to race a Porsche that year and we couldn't find one that was going to race. So I ended up just finding a BMW, because right back then there was no vehicles that were like, right now you can get anything like automatic, and there's all these supercars that are all automatic now and they all have dual clutch transmissions and they're all shiftable with paddle shifters and stuff. But back in 2007, 2010, you couldn't find a paddle shifted vehicle that was affordable. If you could, it was through the roof. It was super expensive. They had a dual clutch transmission or whatever. And so when I was looking for a vehicle that I wanted to be able to shift, I was able to shift and still able to go race and be competitive with the BMW E46. With the SMG transmission, that was the best option. So their SMGs, I don't know if you guys are familiar with it, but it's a six speed, but it has a like a computer actuated clutch. So it, you don't have to use the clutch at all. It's all done mechanically through the computer system. And so I use that, which is really slow as far as racing goes now with technology where it's at. But back then it would work great. So that was the reason I went with that, was to be able to prove the concept of being able to shift and be able to use the controls and adapt them to a vehicle. But now looking back, if things were different, there's so many different avenues you can go these days. It's crazy with all side-by-side stuff and just how far technology's come with different vehicles and such for shifting and transmissions and fast cars are these days is crazy.
Amar, were you self-taught on the software you used for the 3D printing? Because I saw some video on you and you were just moving around different types of cylinders. You're really getting into it. Did you, that self-taught?
Yeah, 100%. Google and YouTube. But yeah, just a curious person, just keep clicking buttons till I figure out how it works.
The first, I guess, generation of your hand controls, do you use a 3D printer?
No, I wish I did, but I didn't have access to a 3D printer back. That's why I'm saying that there's so much technology these days if I were to start over again. I actually spoke at UCLA last week and same question, same situation. It was an engineering class and talking about how to do things now as opposed to back then. And there's so many different avenues of doing it now, but I didn't get a 3D printer until like 2016. And that actually helped a lot. I went to Scandinavia to race over there and I developed a set of hand controls to race in the rallycross car over there because it was completely different. Because I still have to have one hand on the wheel and one hand on the gas and the brake and then one hand on the handbrake as well. So I had to redesign set of hand controls over there and that was an experience. But yeah, I was all self-taught. I learned CAD as a kid working for my dad. Just taught myself that to do plans for him when I was working for him back then. And then I've drawn my whole life, like I was telling you, fabricated and such. So I didn't know the programs and softwares you had to use to 3D model these days. And that was part of it where I was looking for CAD to actually design the stuff because I was going to different machine shops and stuff. I didn't know the process of developing a product. So when I was trying to pitch this to people to get support and help, I was taking these drawings that I did on my sketchbook with just a pencil and stuff. And I was just showing them my concept and whatnot and just trying to ask them to design them for me. But you go to a machine shop and there's no engineers that work on staff there. So they're like, we need dimension joins and blah, blah, blah. We can't cut these out for you. We need to know how to actually cut them and this and that. And I'm like, what the hell's a dimension join? I've never heard of that. So I went and Googled that and figured out, I found Google SketchUp, which is a free software you can download and just, it's all 3D modeling, super, super basic, really. I mean, you can get the point across, but it's very like playing with blocks. And then I found SolidWorks. And so I ended up getting a loan to buy SolidWorks and doing that and purchased that software and the computer and went down that whole rabbit hole of learning that process and software. And that was a huge benefit to being able to get my ideas to essentially paper or whatever and take them to the machine shops and be able to actually create what's in my mind in reality and move forward from there. And I just gotten better at using the software and developing what I needed to develop. Yeah, for the most part, it was just learning as much as I needed to do and much as I could with whatever I was trying to do because it was all new.
So today, you could take your 3D printer and you could design remotely, correct? Yeah. I saw a video where you had to redo the drive controls and it was like a twist throttle with left push forward for the brake and controls were up and downshift. How quickly did you feel that you figure out that whole system?
Yeah, very, I mean, within the first time I took it out, it was a super intuitive. I mean, I'd been designing it in my head for the amount of time that I was, a year or two, so actually it was actually reality. In my head, it was super intuitive. That was the way I designed them to be. It took maybe a half a lap, maybe if that, to get used to it. I took them to like an open parking lot originally just to see if they'd work and if everything was hooked up correctly and they were shifting and all the electronics were working right. And it was so super simple. The hardest thing actually was I had to put a quickener, steering quickener on the rack to be able to reduce the steering input so I can get more steering radius out of the minimal input I was giving it because your hands are stuck at 3 and 9. So that was the main thing, was trying to get the correct turning radius out of how minimal I am inputting. Pretty easy. And aside from that, actually, I had to change the angle that they were coming out of the dash. So like your steering wheel is kind of angled if you're in the car, you know, if you're sitting looking at it, where now mine's coming out of a 90 degree angle. So it rotates on a 90 degree axis. So it's not rotating away from me when I'm turning the wheel. That makes sense.
Yes, it does. Yeah. So take us to your first race.
First race. So my first track day, because it took a while to get... So my first track day was like, I remember thinking like, I pulled on the track, because I'm trying to figure out how to say this, but I was welcomed, but not really welcomed to the track with open arms, because like people shake my hand, they kind of like freak out that I can't really shake their hand, and just they're looking at me like, how are you going to drive a car kind of thing? So my first track day, I... What was it, Sonoma Raceway? And I remember going into the, I talked to him and told him my background, kind of gave them an update. So some of the guys knew who I was and a lot of them didn't know anything about me. I roll in there and it's like a HPDE thing for the high performance driving education is what it stands for. And you got to do, everyone has to do it to get their license to race. But they let me bypass two of the classes because I had my race professional license prior to that. So I bypassed this 1, 2, 3, and 4 and I went into straight into 3 and rolled into the classroom. And one of the instructors stops me and he's like, hey man, he's like, are you lost? Are you in the right way? What are you doing? I'm like, oh man, I'm just here trying to get my education done so I get my license. I go out and race. And I'm like, oh, right on. Well, I think you're in the wrong group. I'm like, no, dude, this is where they told me to go. And he's like, okay, well, this is group 3. He's like, have you ever been to the racetrack before? And I just laugh at him. I'm just like, I didn't know what to say, honestly. I just like, I didn't know how to respond. And he's like, have you ever done laps around the racetrack before? And I'm like, yeah, man, probably more than you. You know what I mean? I didn't mean like a dick. I was like thinking in my head, like, this guy has no idea. And he's like, no, I mean in real life, not on a video game. And I'm just like, wow, bro, like that is ridiculous. In fact, out of the track thinking that they're able to race because they've done it on a video game, it blows my mind. But he probably gets it all the time. But I didn't even say a word. So I just ended up rolling past him. And the other instructor came up and like educated on who I was or whatever. But like that was the response and the reception that I got my first time at the track. And that was the experience. And then when I first went out, we were sitting on the line thinking I saw the guy. And I'm like, all right, we got 4 wheels, an engine, and a pair of balls. These are bigger kind of thing. So we went out the first time and I just freaking blew his doors off. And he didn't know what to say. And yeah. He came up and shook my hand after and he apologized. And then he got like my background and he figured out who I actually was and what I've done and like why I'm able to drive as fast as I was. And that was when I had like my regular set of controls too, where it was just like the Monarch set and like the 60% setup where it was one hand on the wheel and one hand on the gas and brake and kind of sketchy. But yeah, that was the first experience. I kind of really got to it. It got to experience that I can really elaborate on, I think, where it made me feel like a human again, where I felt like I was normal, like I can do what everybody else could as long as I have the right equipment to go out and send it. And now it's like at that point, it's all right, who's got more skills and bigger balls kind of thing. And that was what the playing field was even.
It must have been a great dopamine hit for you, man.
Oh, man. It was total therapy to say the least. Like it was, I can't even explain. Yeah. And that's kind of why when I first developed the controls, I didn't develop them for me to as a business or at all in any way. I didn't even think about anybody else. I'm not as selfish as it sounds. I wanted to go fast and that was what I knew how to do it. And so when I put out the first video online, I was to get sponsors, as attract other people that were stoked on my project and stoked to help me out, want to see me go fast again and blah, blah, blah kind of thing. But I got more messages from different people from all around the world wanting to know if their controls were going to be available for sale and when they're going to be available and if I was going to manufacture them and this and that. So at that point I had to like figure out how to become a businessman and how to be an engineer and be a race car driver, all these different things. And I wasn't ready for any of it. So yeah, it's been still trying to move forward and get these controls out, but it hasn't been an easy situation since the beginning, to be honest. Getting there.
Yeah, you want.
I'm betting on you, man.
You wanted to offer the freedom that you have, right, when you're driving?
Exactly, man. That's just like, you can't really put words into it what it is. So to be able to offer that to somebody else, I feel selfish not to, if they want to go out and do it. And how well they work, I feel obligated to allow people to have that type of freedom, that sense of control over their life again, because that's what it feels like, because you're in control again.
I want to drive. It's just because I've been driving. I started driving after I got hurt about 3 years or 4 years after I got hurt. But like race car driving or just anything other than just normal driving was outside of the realm of possibility for me. I guess it's just not something I thought of, but now like, I've thought about it randomly, but to like see you do that or hear about that, like that's just so cool to me, because when you were talking about that, just going on that, also when you were talking about going on the track for that first time, and I got a bit of a sense of a rush. So I was thinking about the first time I did something that made me feel that rush of dopamine. God, like right now listening to the story, I was just like I want to go and hit something, I guess. I don't know what it is. Like it's just, you know what I mean? Like you just get that energy all of a sudden. And I'm sure you felt that after that finally I can do this thing. I know I can do it now. I'm just doing it better, right? Like, God, like, I don't know. I was listening to you right now. I got pumped. I'm sorry.
Oh man, that's what it's all about. We're supposed to pump each other up. So that's why I feel selfish to not be able to give other people the opportunity to go out and send it and have fun and just have a good time. So that's what I'm mainly working on. One of the things I'm working on is for next year, but I'm not really concentrating on my own career as much anymore, because I'd rather put track days together and get the cars all set up for other people to come out and experience a good time and have a good time with other people. So that's where I'm at with that. But
How long did it actually take you to get on the racetrack and actually try to win a race?
Almost a year. So I'm trying to think of when it actually was. But it takes a minute to go through all the classes to get your license. And I think it took about, maybe not a year, maybe it felt like a year. Or no, it was a year because I ended up blowing up my car. So my first car that I built, I blew up. So I got all my licensing done. And then on the last day for that, I ended up blowing up my car. And that's why I ended up building the BMW and ended up going building the controls for the BMW. So I had a Mitsubishi originally, all-wheel drive, like a Mitsubishi Eclipse twin turbo. It was a fun car. I built it for this. It was a quick car, 450 horsepower, all-wheel drive, good time. But pissed a lot of people off because it was just some Japanese car that no one knew what the hell it was. And I thought it was some racer car, but I knew what I was doing when I built it. So it was definitely set up nice. I still have it, actually. But it's sitting, so that'll be, it's another project. So once I have more money to waste. But yeah, so that thing blew up, and then it took me another year to get, not another year, but the next season. So it took me the following season to get into the actual race. So about a year, I guess, getting my license and getting my...
Yeah, one of the races that I watched on your YouTube page was the 2021 IRX All-Star Invitational. Did you flip in that race?
So those are sim races. When COVID hit, all the drivers got sent onto the virtual world. So like all my homies, they created this IRX series. It was called the Invitational Rallycross Experiment. It was all invitational, basically. So it was drivers from all different industries. So like if you look at like Travis Pastrana, freaking Scott Speed, a bunch of like Ron Capps, people from drag racing, road racing, car race or Porsche racing, all different aspects of racing were out there. So it was a good time, but we were all in COVID. So when that happened, I had to develop a set of controls for sim racing because I had never done that. I had never played video games really. So that was when the 3D printer came in handy, and I got all my 3D printer or all my sim stuff, and then developed a set of hand controls on the 3D printer and was kind of developing them during the season, which was unfortunate, but I got it done. But it was, I was in the development process throughout the whole series. And never really got them in tune to when I was actually able to qualify for the rest of the actual season and for the actual championship. But it was a fun experience, to say the least, as far as being locked away in COVID and having to get to be able to play with everybody. Yeah, I think it's a great avenue for people because that's another reason I want to get the controls done for the sim stuff. People can go do that as well and experience it because it's a little cheaper and not as dangerous and a little more accessible. But that's another project on my list of things to do.
Is that your Reality P3 Motion setup you have, those three screens?
Yeah, I actually sold that, but that was it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I sold it, and I sold it. I built two other ones, and I sold those two. So I sold them all to different people. Just that was kind of my thing during COVID. I was building simulators. Kind of got into that whole industry, but yeah, no, that thing was cool while it lasted, for sure.
Yeah, simulators, like that's something I'm sure there's a lot of people that want to just go out and try that, and simulating would be one of those main things. It's like video games, right? You were talking about video games right now. I don't really get to play video games, but like we're always having to, it's always like people with disabilities or whatever, trying to figure these things out and make these things possible for everyone else. You just reminded me I need to work on, I've been wanting to get this little arcade thing going with bigger buttons and stuff, building them so I can just play arcade games like the old school. That's something I've been messing with because earlier when you were talking about CAD and SOLIDWORKS and the 3D printing, because I used to be the robotics teacher at school, and we had to do all those things and come up with like different ideas and build things ourselves. Doing all that stuff is like really fun. I don't have time to do it, but yeah, it's just you can create so many different things. And we had a group of kids that created using the robotics, they created this extension for this kid. It was their project. It was an extension for a kid that had his left arm was, he had gotten it amputated for some reason. So they used the robotics and all that stuff to like create this extension so the kid can reach things with his left arm. It was really cool. But like all these little things from just simple ideas to just do these really cool things that you're doing, it's awesome.
Hey Mario, was it just a random thought for you to make a hand control for an RC car?
That was COVID induced.
We had a lot of time to just come up with ideas and just try it.
You should watch the video. It is so clever the way he set it up.
It's pretty basic, like, for sure. It works. Exactly. It's
like, no, that'll work. It's like, dude, that's pretty simple, but it got it done. The other question I have for you, Mara, is your hand control, did they ever get ADA approved?
No, they did not. That was also like a struggle that I was trying to figure out, was legalities through everything and trying to not be sued and send someone a basically a death device if they use it the wrong way. So,
all the like the copyright stuff and all that nonsense.
Yeah, got it and everything on everything, but at the same time, it's like I don't even know if it was worth the hassle. It's been a project that's gotten sidelined, unfortunately, that I really need to get back on board and get things done with. But, one thing I'm really focusing on this next year coming together is like I said, getting those cars back on the track and getting these controls out to people, because that's been a long time coming and they need to get done.
How many just generally people out there that you've met along the way, is there just like a pretty big population of people that want to try driving and doing these things that I would never have thought possible before?
There's a lot of people, like a lot more than I was expecting for sure. And then I've gotten a lot of people that they just think the controls make you a race car driver also, which is like a hard reality to accept. It's not. Like, I put in a whole lot of work and people don't really see that aspect of it. And so that's where I'm afraid to just let them go to anybody as well, because people just think that you could just pop them in a car and all of a sudden you're able to control it, because that's what I'm doing. But that's not the case at all. Like, it takes a lot of exercise outside of the vehicle to be able to go out and not take out somebody's McLaren or someone's $1 million vehicle. That's where it gets kind of sticky as far as moving the needle forward, I guess, and knowing which direction to kind of make it happen. Yeah. Right, so
what's life today for Mr. Mario Bonfanti?
Oh, okay. Today. So, guess good a time as ever. I haven't really told many people, but I am starting a new career path in finance and work in that direction. So I just got certified for my life insurance stuff to be able to sell all that and help people with annuities and their insurance plan, or not insurance plans, but their life insurance, and excited to get started with that. Been working with a buddy since I've been back in Gilroy to get started with that. It's been kind of scary, to be honest. New world, money and all that. Definitely learning a lot. So excited to be seeing where it all goes. That's for the first time in my life, I'm not really putting racing first. So that's why I'm excited to have a chance to sit back and finally get the controls, like not be focused on myself. Because being a professional, whatever you are, whether you play tennis, golf, whatever, it's a very selfish thing. So to not have to be selfish with my emotions, my finances, my time, my everything as much as I have been, and be able to focus on different things now moving forward, I'm excited to have that opportunity to be able to see what happens and see what the energy brings.
Something new is always good, right? Yeah. Just trying something new and something exciting, kind of doing different areas, different directions.
It's opportunities, man.
Opportunities, big time.
And if you put as much effort as you have with everything else, Mario, I think you're going to knock it out of the ballpark, man.
Absolutely.
Appreciate that. But yeah, we'll see what happens, man. So I'm excited to be back. I'm just back up in the area since I took the year off. I moved back to my hometown and my brother and sister had kids. So I've been hanging out with my nephews and stuff, and they both started racing BMX recently and doing my whole life over again. So it's exciting to be around and to see. Just enjoying that.
Up a little bit.
Definitely. Exactly. Appreciating slowing down a little bit finally for the first time, trying to go find a wife and make some kids. We'll see what happens.
You're about full circle. Yeah.
Yeah. About that time. I'm getting old, man. That's what happens.
So I'm going to leave you with one last question. I'm going to ask you, it says, what advice would you give someone who's struggling to get back up after life knocks them down?
Find your why. I mean, figure out what makes you tick. Why do you keep wanting and why do you want to move forward? What makes life worth it? And enjoy the little things. I mean, the little wins. Celebrate all the little wins in life in general. Making your bed, brushing your teeth, checking off your checklist. Make a list of what you want and start checking it off and working towards it. The world keeps spinning every day. So if you just set a goal and you keep moving towards it, eventually you're going to get there. So you just got to act and move. And painful as it is sometimes, just keep moving. Keep them spinning. Keep moving in the direction you want to be going in. Otherwise, you're just gonna be wasting time spinning your wheels, and it's not hard. Just gotta do it.
Yeah.
So I gotta get to work then. I'm in a tie light. I'm in a beat chair. I need to get a chair really bad. That's on my list, but they're just so expensive. The insurance only covers so much, and I have certain preferences of certain things I like, and they don't want to do that for me. So I've just been waiting to buy my own. Well, I mean, I don't need a bunch of adjustments. So I don't need an adjustable chair. I need welded fixed setups, and I'm pretty hard on my chair, so I can't use an aluminum frame. I bend them. I've gone through quite a few of them. Yeah, titanium rigid, and that's what they won't replace mine with. And I have a titanium rigid right now that I bought myself, but insurance won't cover it. So,
we have a lot. If you have any questions on wheelchairs, anything, you can contact Roland or myself, because that's what we do. Roland more, because he's got more experience on, especially seating. And if you have a certain, like Tylite, we know the Tylite people, you know,
We can just get us a quote number and we can see what we can do for you.
Yeah. And I was talking about, like, you can still get that titanium through your insurance. You just have to cover the titanium portion of it.
Okay. Yeah. The highlight carbon they have, I just saw was dope. But yeah, whatever you guys can do, I'd really appreciate it. That'd be awesome.
Cause... Yeah. Just let us know when it's time for that. And
why don't you just give him a call later, Roland? Y'all can work
it out. For sure. I'll hit you up on Facebook. I saw somebody you may know just this morning. I was like, oh, wow. All right, let me get to know him first, and I'll hit him up. I'll be a weirdo.
I have like 300 people on my Facebook I haven't added because I don't know most of them. But
well, we're gonna request your brother.
Right on, man. Well, I appreciate you guys. This is great.
Thank you. We thank you for taking Saturday out to talk to us.
Appreciate you, brother. And anytime you want to come back on the show, you're more than welcome. And you got our cell number, so you can stay in touch with us.
Right on. Well, it sounds like we might have to do this follow up when Danny gets on track. So let's do
there
it.
There you go.
Sounds good.
Okay. Come down. Let's do this.
We'll get it done.
Yeah. All right. There you go.
All right, Mar. Thank you. And thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Wheelchair Roundtable. Thank you. Cheers.
Bye-bye.